Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, God exists in Sudan despite it all. They kept the faith in Lithuania. And a Lenten conversation about Leo the Great with our favourite Latinist. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. This past week, the bishops of Sudan were in Rome on their ad limina visit, meeting with Pope Benedict XVI. Sudan is a nation I have very much at heart, since I was privileged enough to meet with many of these Sudanese bishops during the 2009 October Synod for Africa. Among these, the Bishop of Tombura Yambio, Edward Hiboro Kusala, and the Auxiliary Bishop of Khartoum, Daniel Marco Kur Adwok. So what I'll be doing in a moment is share with you some of their thoughts. Let's begin by listening to Bishop Daniel. How do you reconcile this violence there is in your country with the existence of God? Is God in Sudan?
Oh yes, there is God in Sudan. Oh, there is God, there is God. 23 years of civil war. We have walked with our people. We have walked with our people. They have known through the different Eucharistic celebrations in public squares. They knew that we spiritual leaders, we bishops, we were powerless. And they knew that the only strength that can keep them going and continuing to witness their Christian faith was the strength in God, in their faith. It came out very, very, very strongly in the Christians who were there, who are now in the Sudan. Their faith in God keeps them alive. And you get that from the very, very marginalized, very poor people who maybe today will not have anything to eat at home, but neither will he go or she go and sell her faith away because she slept angry. So I think it is from there that we begin our journey to search for justice in our country. It is from our faith. We will not abandon it.
There is a church in Sudan.
There is a church in Sudan, yeah. It's a poor church, but it is a church that is alive. The servant of God, Pope John Paul II, told the Cardinal Zubair, who was the Archbishop of Khartoum, when he climbed a high place to view the people who came to meet him in 1993, he told Cardinal Zubair, he said, "Look, I thought these people would be afraid and hiding, but these people, they frighten you." You see, and then he said, "Yes, I mean, these people, they really do frighten. I mean, they have faith.
They frighten you in a good sense.
They frighten you in a good sense. I mean, you really feel that they are not afraid of anything. They profess their faith and openly, and without looking even behind that there is any danger at all."
You were listening there to the Auxiliary Bishop of Khartoum, Daniel Marco Kur Adwok, who introduced me to another fellow bishop from his nation, one to witness persecution of Christians in a special way in his diocese, the Diocese of Tombura Yambio in southern Sudan. His name is Edward Hiboro Kusala, and in August, among the ongoing violence, he witnessed the crucifixion of Christians. I thought I'd ask him, given his personal experience, what kind of relevance the Synod discussions focusing around reconciliation, justice, and peace could possibly have for him at all.
Yeah, this Synod, to me, has been a moment of reflection. a self-conversion and moment of coming to terms with the realities in which I live. I come from a country that has a long history of violence, and me personally lost my mom when I was just 2 months old in the same violence. So she was murdered. She was murdered by military people. So I have taken upon myself many years before interest of resolving and working for peace. So this synod has been an opportunity for me as such to re-examine my attitude towards promotion of peace, and knowing the fact that I have to come to terms really with what I have lived through, the pain, the suffering, the despair. I've worked with that, I've lived with that, and I have to accept it. The topic is difficult. Reconciliation is not a simple thing, it's a process. And the real issue is it needs a space. It needs a place where one can be able to come to terms with himself or herself in order to say, yes, this is my story. Things have gone wrong, things have spoiled, but I still can make a new step. And looking at the same way, this the same for me and for any other Africans, we look at our history, how much we have been humiliated by history, by many things, but we still see this is not the end. There's still a victory. We look at Christ on the cross. He did not remain on the cross. Behind the cross, there is victory, there is joy. So this is a moment for us to convert ourselves and be able to walk out of what has happened in our history and be able to work for betterment of the country, of the continent from which we come. And I think we are also challenged to take it seriously as a part of our apostolate, this work for peace. Because we indeed become the children of God. We need to take it as our daily pastoral work wherever we are. And that's what I'm going to do. And that's what actually I've been trying to do, to spread the spirit of reconciliation and putting in place justice and peace. The real difficulty with this is we are going to work with people who do not understand this language, who do not even believe that what they are doing is just their duty. There's nothing wrong with it. Who will not even be able to listen to us or to me, who will not see me as an equal, who don't see that talking about a reconciliation with someone who's different, maybe from a different religion, different ethnic group, he is a minor person, he's just a lower person. I can't equal up talking to such a person. This is the challenge we are going to find. But of course, it is a duty that we must work to build peace in Sudan. And that's a work we have to take as a church, I have to take as people of Sudan, to work to build a reconciliation in our country. And the other thing, of course, is also to advocate on our behalf with people of other communities, the Friends of Africa, the Europeans, the Arabs, the Asians. We need to capture what can bring peace in Africa. We need respect for ourselves as Africans by promoting good governance and respect for common good and for human life. We also to expect that from our brothers and sisters. Some of them humiliated us so much in the past. I think it's a moment also for them to convert and be able to help Africa and to work together with Africa to come out of this poverty in which we are living and the conflict that is going on. Because at a certain point, when you look at the conflicts going on within our countries and in our continent, you see the string going all the way out of the continent. There are people who like to sponsor those things, who like to benefit while we are all in confusion. And this is also, this synod has helped us to pass this message to them. And also asking our Christian brothers who believe in the value of human life to insist with their government to respect Africa and be able to have system that can promote this continent so that we live together. I belong to human family, human tribe, and that's what I see for everybody. So I think the future is not desperate. What has been very interesting is that our stories are the same, and I see a lot of strong will to make things work. It's a moment that we need to get in dialogue with ourselves at home We need to talk to ourselves as Africans. We need to talk to our leaders. We need to talk to those who are in charge to see that we get rid of these problems in Africa. There's been a moment of conversion. We need God in our history. We need to put Christ in our history, in the midst of our own working conditions, so that the world can be purified, the world can be brought to perfection, and peace can be stable in our midst, and we indeed can be called children of God. And that's what we really need to make ourselves salty. We have lost our saltiness, and we need to reinforce it, to be salty and be the true light of the world.
You were listening there to the Bishop of Tombura Yambio, Edward Hiboro Kusala, and before that to the Auxiliary Bishop of Khartoum, Daniel Marco Kur Adwok. Warm thanks to both of them for sharing with us these thoughts. And now, why not move north of this African nation to Lithuania, currently celebrating the 20th anniversary of independence precisely on Thursday, 11th of March. An independence which put an end to communist rule and to difficult years for many, including Catholics, who had the courage to keep the faith alive, as the Cardinal Archbishop of this nation's capital, Vilnius, Audris Bačkis, is about to tell us. Lithuania has a checkered history, a painful history. It had a communist regime, a Soviet occupation for over 50 years, I think. It was interspersed with a Nazi occupation. During this period, the Lithuanians clung on to their faith. Is that a correct statement in your view? What are we talking about when we're talking about suffering and persecution of Catholics?
Certainly, after the Soviet occupation, I mean the first one, in 1940, there was a lot of persecution against the church and the intellectuals. There was, in June 1940, the deportation to Siberia, about 40,000 people, but they were chosen, the elite. 100 more priests, let's say the mayor of the village, the intellectuals, things like that. So it was a very strong blow to the country. A lot of suffering, but people who have grown in a Catholic surrounding, the faith, and were able, even in Siberia, even elsewhere, to keep the faith. It's wonderful now today. I saw some religious congregations, some girls were born in Siberia. So it means that the parents were able, in this condition, where there were no priest, no church, nothing, to keep alive the faith. So then it was a persecution. After there was the Nazi occupation for 4 years, and the most difficult thing at that time, sometimes some people had a sense of guilt, it was the persecution of the Jews. About 200,000 Jews were deported from Lithuania. Of course, it was done by the Nazis, but, well, many Lithuanians defended and took risk in defending some other, as usual, or were passive or collaborate. But then, after the second occupation of 1944, the government wanted to take control of the church, beginning from the head. So it was directed against the bishops. We refused to collaborate, closing down the seminary, not closing down, putting a so-called numerus clausus, a maximum, up to 25 students. There were 400 seminaries before the war. So. The blow against the bishop is very simple. The Archbishop of Vilnius, Rainis, my predecessor, died in the prison of Vladimir in 1953. He was arrested in 1948, in 1953 died. Another bishop, Borisevich from Telšiai, in the north of the country, quickly executed in Vilnius itself. Some others were sent to the jail, so that in 1967 there was only one bishop left in all Lithuania for six dioceses. Some fled abroad, that's true, Archbishop of Kaunas and two auxiliary bishops, but those who remained in the country were really in very difficult situation. So the seminary was also one of the targets. You cannot enter the seminary if you have made higher studies and things like that. They were trying to keep the lowest level.
And what happened on a daily basis there?
To make catechesis was forbidden. I mean, if you meet with three young people, it was a crime. It could be... And so the priests, little by little, were pushed to a ministry only of sacraments. They only distribute the sacraments, don't get out, don't have contact with the people, avoid all that. And the church survived, I would say, thanks to some very courageous priests, and mostly some very courageous lay people. I think it's the families, mostly the mothers, were able to transmit what they believe in to their children, things like that. So it was a time of great witness of faith up to the martyrs, the persecution. But then our occupation in Lithuania lasted 50 years.
A big thank you there to the Cardinal Archbishop of Vilnius, Audris Bačkis, for sharing with us this information. Finally, on a completely different note, let's join our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, for a Lenten conversation on one of his favourite subjects, Leo the Great. Father Foster, you're always talking to me about the sermons of Pope Leo the First, Pope Leo the Great, during Lent. What was special about those sermons?
There are 11. Every year he did this. Every year he had one, and so forth and so on about Lent. And
do they correspond to the actual Sundays in Lent? Or
No. Well, no. It would be like the beginning of Lent. You know, that would like the theme of Lent. Of course, you know, the idea of atonement for sin and...
How do you say all these things in Latin, atonement for sin?
Peccatorum nescio reparatio. That's all right.
And the pillars of our faith.
And so, yeah, certainly.
Like the Pope went strong on almsgiving this year, no? How do you say almsgiving?
Well, the fact is that is very strong in Leo, 1600 years ago, because he's extremely modern, you know? Where he says, you know, instead of crucifying yourself, you know, I'm giving up candy, I'm giving up pizzas for Lent. He said, fine, if you want to do that, then you take what you're going to save by these penances and you give these things to the poor and the needy.
How'd you say all that in Latin?
Well, a genus et pauperibus tradenda sunt quae colligimus ex sacrificius nostris. You can say anything.
You didn't talk about the pizzas. Chocolate.
No, not right now, no, but...
but you have a word for pizza and...
Well, certainly.
And chocolate.
Well, certainly we have all that stuff.
And drink. How do you say? Give up pizza, chocolate,
yes, and drink. Ergo repudiate, teobroma is chocolate, and pizzas are lagana. Laganum. Horace talks about a laganum, and it was like a cake made with cheese and oil. Comes very close to our pizza.
And almsgiving, how do you say almsgiving?
That's eleemosyna, your Greek word, which is in every language now.
So basically, we talked about fasting, we talked about almsgiving and prayer. How do you say prayer?
Did he
tell you to pray, Leo the Great?
Oh, yeah, well, there's no problem there.
How do you say?
To pray for yourself and for others, and this whole spiritual exercise, it was supposed to be like a spiritual training ground.
He says in his first reflection on Lent, according to what I found on internet, chapter 5 talks about abstinence, not only from food, but from other evil desires, especially from wrath, which you say is wrath. Is that right?
Wrath, yes. Ira.
Ira, that's easy. Is required.
No, he says that we don't have to. Don't worry about abstaining from meat and stuff, but abstain from bad things, from bad habits. No, he's very, very strong and very, very clear.
He says, let the swellings of pride subside. Let wrath or wrath yield to reason. How do you say that?
That's what he says. A tumor ire, nescio decrescat, et concedat. What did he say for the... I forget the rest of the sentence there. Let it give into... He says it much better, but anyway.
Let the swellings of pride subside. Let wrath or wrath yield to reason. Let the darts of ill treatment be shattered. then the chidings of the tongue be bridled.
No.
Let thoughts of revenge fall through and injuries be given over to oblivion. Let the swellings of pride subside.
Two more. Superbiae residat.
Let
ira
wrath
Ratione cedat.
Yield to reason. Let the darts of ill-treatment be shattered.
Injuriarum. Frangantur.
And the chidings of the
reprehensiones of the
tongue be bridled.
Reprehensiones linguae. Frenentur. It's really great.
Let thoughts of revenge fall through and injuries be given over to oblivion.
Decedant cogitationes ulciones et injurie oblivioni tradantur. That's easy. He says it in a much nicer way, but anyway.
Well, he says, let every plant which the Heavenly Father hath not planted be removed by the roots. That's a nice image.
Certainly. Radicitus omnis planta, quam pater celestis non, we're going to say, seruit, eradicetur.
For then only are the seeds of virtue well nourished in us.
The seeds of virtue are virtutis semina in nobis nutriuntur.
And every
Germen, cum omne extrarium germen,
uprooted
evelitur de frumenti segete.
That's wheat. Every foreign.
I said.
Germ uprooted from the field of wheat. But no, for our listeners, we didn't say it in English.
Oh, that's great. No, it's great, really. Ooh.
And he also says further down, if you read, and we can't read it all. I mean, forgive us our debts.
We have in the Our Father there one.
But who read these things? I mean, did he speak them?
For sure.
I mean, were they sermons or what?
Well, certainly. Were they called tractatus, tracts? But I mean, they certainly, I warn the students too, they certainly weren't written to be read, but they were given to be heard. And that's why we insist in school on the music of his sentences. There's a musical
rhythm.
It's out of this world. And it's really to pronounce this out loud. I have the students do that. Pronounce these things out loud. Close your eyes and pronounce them out loud. It's really another experience.
Maybe you should start your own radio station.
Come on, fire. Now, I have these things on tape, you know. I told you that. All of his sermons are on tape on the internet.
Who did you do them for?
Oh, for one of the students. I think there are 96 sermons. We filled about 15 tapes, the old system. And then they transferred this onto CDs.
And do you manage to capture the musical sound?
Well, I try to. Certainly the inflection of your voice, there's a progression there. It's really very, very beautiful. It's almost like reading, I would say, decent poetry, Shakespeare, or some classical poet. There's a rhythm there and a beauty.
Leo the Great always spoke about religious matters. These are sermons for Lent, so obviously they're religious. But did he actually have ordinary poetry
nature? No.
Nothing is frivolous.
We don't have, maybe he on the side.
Is there a particular sermon that you like, that you'd like to speak to us about?
Oh, I don't know why there's so many. I mean, I don't know what. I mean, his sermons on Christmas are the end of the world, really.
No, we're talking about Easter now.
I understand, but you asked me which ones.
We'll get to those at Christmas.
Well, yeah, I understand. When he gets on the incarnation and God becoming man and one of us and sharing and everything we have. It's just too much.
But the sermon I've been reading from on abstinence was number 5. Number 6 leads to a happy participation in Easter. So basically everything he wrote was to geared towards Easter. No?
Oh, yeah. He says that in the first sentence. A preparation time for Easter and so forth. The greatest mystery, of course, is the Easter mystery and so forth.
One in this In a paragraph he says, "Let us not pass over the groans of the poor with deaf ear, but with prompt kindness bestow our mercy on the needy, that we may deserve to find mercy in the judgment." How does one say, "Let us not pass over the groans of the poor with deaf ear"?
Yeah, sordis auribus ne praeteriamus, gemitus pauperum.
But with prompt kindness bestow our mercy on the needy.
Alec, alacri, alacri, beninitate. Bestow what?
Our mercy.
Ah, misericordiam tribuamus.
On the needy.
Ah, bene, e gentibus.
That we may deserve to find mercy in thy judgment.
Misericordiam consequi valeamus in judicio. Yeah, those are glorious things, really. I mean, they're immortal. Now they want me during Lent now. Every day for about 5 minutes, I'm supposed to read from Leo. And everyone just moans and groans. It's so glorious. You say, look at how he says it, how he says this. And then we're supposed to be so modern and we have all the best ideas. We have nothing, friends. Really, in comparison to these great men.
Why do you think that is? Do you think because it was a different world they belonged to?
Well, for one, of course, there's a natural talent there. Not all popes wrote or spoke like Leo did. They just didn't. They just didn't. It's like not everyone wrote music like Mozart.
You're a sort of talent scout. How do you say that with your students? So how would you say talent scout?
Okay. Well, you'd say virtutum explorator.
Someone talent scouted you years ago. How long ago was that?
It was my teacher.
That was Cardinal Bacci, no?
Well, no. It was actually his successor, Carl Egger, who died about 3 years ago. And so I had him in class. There were three of us in class, and then the Pope's secretary got sick. And Benelli and Paul VI said
Cardinal Benelli.
Well, he was just an archbishop then. Anyway, as a substitute upstairs. And they said, we need someone to do this work. And one of my teachers said, I think I know the man you're looking for. And that was that.
Has your Latin improved over the years, or
has it got
worse?
Oh, yeah. You get, even like Cicero, the older you get, the more mellow you get. I mean, not youthful, you know, sparklings and, you know, a big show and stuff like that, which I like to do. Well, I have my own style. But the older you get, the more mellow you get. And it's interesting to see that Cicero's last orations are real kind of nice guy of a, not 23. Mm. There's a difference.
So mellow, Father Foster, how'd you say mellow?
Mitesco, mitescere. Mitescere, it's a me to it. Fosterius me to it. Foster mellowed. Well, we all do, I hope.
And heartfelt thanks, as always, to our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, who has spent most of his life working as the Pope's own Latinist. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now. You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio, Laudetur Jesus Christus.